This is episode 3 Foxtrot of Free As in Freedom. Hi, I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn.
And this is Free As in Freedom.
So we're recording across the Pacific and the continent tonight, or this morning for me.
Yeah, it's a long distance recording.
Yeah, so this is kind of, I feel like I'm doing Linux Outlaws. Of course, they're both in the UK now, so they weren't doing it across many countries anymore. But now we are.
Oh, I didn't realize that Fab was in the UK.
Yeah, he works for the H in the UK now.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, but the one's in Liverpool and one's in London, but still. They're still remote.
That's much closer than we are now.
That's correct, but you have one recording device, I have another, and we have a back channel phone connection, so all using free software except for your recording device, which is actually Conservancy's recording device that has proprietary software on it. It's the same one we use to record the FOSDEM talks. And that leads us to the transition of having another FOSDEM talk for people to hear.
Yeah, we're slowly, much slower, more slowly getting through them than we had hoped. And I, for one, am really sorry about that.
Well, it's been difficult. We both have jobs that we've talked about before, and people know are demanding, and they've taken both of us to do various things. I would encourage people again to donate to the campaign for the Software Freedom Conservancy for the nonprofit accounting software. We're getting closer and closer. So if people can get up there and donate, we're at the point now where only 300, at least when we record this, only 300 people need to give $100 and we'd be done. So we have more than 300 listeners. So, you know, folks, please.
Boy, how do I not plug the GNOME Privacy Campaign?
Well, you should.
I don't want to be like, you know, hey, everybody.
They should give $100 to us and $100 to that. And if they can't afford $100 to each, they could give $50 to each.
Exactly.
Most people who are listening to us live in the industrialized world and have reasonably good jobs, comparatively to the people who have to take apart electronics on coasts of India and so forth. So, you can afford it, I think.
Yeah, totally.
So, how do they donate to the GNOME Privacy Campaign?
How do they donate to it?
Yeah.
Oh, GNOME.org. Okay. There's a banner at the top.
Yeah, if you go to sfconservancy/campaign, or there's a big colorful campaign button you can click on to donate to Conservancy's campaign. So in this is a panel discussion we're about to hear. And
it's a great panel discussion, I think.
Do you think so? Did the audience, how was it easy for you to hear the audience questions and comments?
I thought so. There were a couple of times when I wasn't sure. Did you not listen to it again? I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I listened to it again a couple months ago. Yeah. But yeah, I was just curious if you were able to hear them. I heard them okay, but I was also on the panel, so I remembered it pretty well.
I was also in the room.
Yeah, but I actually was on the panel, so I was able to. I basically knew what everybody, because I had to think through what I was going to say at the time. So I could fill in any information that I wanted to from my memory.
I thought it was a very lively panel.
Yeah, there was an interesting exchange folks will hear between Fontana and an audience member, which was an interesting exchange, and people afterwards said they liked it. I thought we got a little bit too much down a rat hole, and basically it was being responsive to somebody in the audience who was trolling, and the problem was that Fontana really wanted to cover that issue. And kept referencing the guy, which just made it all worse. So folks will hear that. I think that was not the best part of the panel. There was some people liked it, but I think that detached from it a little bit. But hopefully folks will enjoy it.
Well, without any further ado, maybe we should just play the audio, and we'll be back to talk about it a little bit after.
Yep. Okay, well, with that, thank you. Our last talk of the day will be our AGPL panel
Richard, I'll let you introduce everyone.
Sure. Maybe I should actually let people introduce themselves. And I would ask the panelists to maybe tailor their introductions slightly, at least to the topic at hand, which is the topic of the talk is the panel is the AGPL, the GNU Affair General Public License version 3 is the full name. And it is a license that has an importance that exceeds the degree to which it's been adopted, I would say, and it has a certain special place in the kind of framework of free software and open source licenses. So with that introduction, Bradley, why don't you talk about yourself? You have a very unique background when it comes to the AGPL.
I'm Bradley Kuhn, and I indeed have a special relationship with the Affair AGPL. I've done various things in free software, but the thing that I feel is my claim to fame is that I came up with the idea of how to implement the Affero clause in a copyright license to flag it on the modification. Originally, behind the idea of a program that prints its own source code, the idea if your program was able to print its own source code, you couldn't remove that feature in future versions, and modified versions had to do that. It's not based around the idea of a program printing its own source code anymore, but the basic concept is still there. I helped draft the first Affero GPL, which was basically an authorized fork of GPL v2. I am 33% to 40% responsible for the Affero clause not being in a GPL v2.2 that was floating around. I stupidly talked RMS out of releasing, I was part of the team that talked RMS out of releasing GPL v2.2 with the Affero clause in it. And as most people know, it was relegated to a separate license called the Affero GPL during the v3 process. And that merged the GPL family back together from the fork. But I obviously wanted this to be in the GPL v3 clause. So it'd be a clause in GPL v3 itself.
And also, you're on the board of the FSF.
That's correct.
President and executive director of the Software Freedom Conservancy.
Yeah, but this, I'm here primarily as an FSF board member, because we don't have any AGPL projects in the Conservancy, but FSF obviously is a proponent and a fundraiser for an AGPL project you're going to hear about in a minute.
Right. So, Eileen?
Yes, Eileen Evans. I'm the vice president for open source at HP. I also have a role where I lead legal support for our cloud organizations as well. So a little bit, in my role at HP, I have the opportunity to lead our open source program office, open source strategy. So it involves our internal compliance efforts, obviously, but also our external outreach and community engagement. So I sit on the OpenStack board of directors, representing HP. We also recently upped our membership to the Linux Foundation to platinum membership just a couple of months ago. So we're definitely increasing our open source community engagement across the board. This was a particular, I wanted to participate in this particular topic because we do get a lot of questions on AGPL. And it's not just internally, but we have a lot of, enterprise customers. And when we're working on deals with enterprise customers, this is a question that comes up a lot. So this is something that I've talked to Richard about, I've talked to Bradley about, and others in the community. I've talked to colleagues with other companies. So it's a topic of very extreme importance right now. My background is I joined HP a couple of years ago. I joined actually from Oracle. I moved to Oracle through its acquisition of Sun Microsystems, where I was for 12 years. And at Sun, I had the opportunity to lead and support and manage a number of different open source projects and communities, from Java to Open Solaris. When we open sourced it, I had the opportunity to lead that, and I drafted CDDL. And I know you have issues with that, Richard, but I drafted CDL at the time. We had some issues with MPL, and we were trying to solve those for the community and for some of our customers. But nonetheless, so I've been involved in open source for quite some time. I've involved when we acquired MySQL. I focused on the acquisition and integration of MySQL as well. So I've been involved for the open source for quite some time.
I actually like CDL.
Thank you.
Some say it's better than MPL 2.0.
Yep.
So,
Chris Weber.
Yeah, so I'm Chris Weber. I guess I started getting, I've been a free software activist for a long time. I guess I started getting involved in kind of the licensing pedantry, I guess through working at Creative Commons previously, which I've now left, and I'm now literally work for the internet because I was funded with a crowdfunding campaign we did with the Free Software Foundation to pay for me to work full time on GNU Media Goblin, which is a kind of like a decentralized media hosting service, and it's under the AGPL. So that's the whole reason that I'm here, because of my project, because I know how to ask annoying licensing questions. So
even though I'm a mere moderator, I'm going to introduce myself.
You're not a mere moderator.
No.
Okay.
Because, moderator.
So I'm Richard.
Super moderator.
Richard Fontana. I'm Red Hat's open source lawyer, I guess I would say, and I've been at Red Hat for 5 years. But before then, I worked at the Software Freedom Law Center with Bradley and Aaron, if Aaron is in the audience, and others.
He's back there.
Oh yeah. I worked with mainly with Eben Moglen and Richard Stallman on drafting the GPLv3 family. So that included the Affero GPLv3. I was actually the person who recommended that the FSF draft its own authorized variant of GPLv3 that would have an Affero clause, because that was sort of a compromise solution between two very opposing camps during the various discussions around the drafting of GPLv3. And so I had a significant part in drafting the license, and so it matters to me a lot for that reason. And I've also had to deal with the encountering the license and thinking about the license in my work at Red Hat as well. So why don't we start with Bradley, since you were present at the creation, as it were. Can you explain what the policy basis was for coming up with that fork of GPLv2?
Well, the catalyst credit for creating the Affero GPL belongs pretty solely to a guy named Henry Poole, who was starting a business, a web service business at the time, to help actually nonprofits fundraise, and he was building a platform to do that. And he pointed out at the time what a lot of people were, which at the time they called the application service provider, ASP, loophole of GPL. And I always hated that phrase because I didn't see it as a loophole. GPL was not drafted in the web services era, so it's very difficult in a license drafting to see the future. It always tries to, but it usually doesn't do a great job at seeing the future. And so that's why GPLv2 didn't really deal with this issue. And Henry basically said, which many people were saying at the time, in the era of network services, the GPL and the BSD license have almost nothing different about them, because GPL was centered around the idea of distribution and actually distributing a binary to someone, and most people who use a web service don't receive a binary of the main part of the web service. It runs on the server. And he wanted a license, and that's why FSF authorized the fork and was considering it for GPLv2 and GPLv3, ultimately ending up in Affero GPLv3. And so he really deserves that credit for sort of bringing this issue and saying the FSF must deal with this. It's very important. And I wish we'd dealt with it more. I wish FSF had done more historically with the Affero GPL and on this issue. It's tried, but I think we should have done more, because it's such a huge issue now.
So, and just to be clear about what you see the problem as, is that because binaries aren't distributed, you're not getting source code where you would be in a traditional GPL context.
Right. My view is that all software that you use or interact with should be free software. I believe that's a moral right that people ought to have, that they should have an inalienable right to the source code of all their software. Many of the software programs that people use today are provided to you, like Gmail, as a network service. And it's actually in a mix of proprietary JavaScript that actually is distributed in the normal way and some server-side stuff. I think people have a moral right to have that. And for those who believe in that, as, for example, the GNU Media Project, GNU Media Goblin Project does, they should have a license that requires this in a copyleft sense, that exactly what copyleft is designed for, to make sure that as the software propagates through the world, the freedoms are defended.
So Eileen, before AGPLv3 existed, and when you were at Sun, there was certainly a lot of talk about the ASP loophole, and you were involved deeply in open source issues. So you must have been aware of that issue being relevant at that time. Was that something that Sun developers were thinking about, or even Sun business people, Sun lawyers?
I think they were. I mean, absolutely. I think Sun was very proactive in open source. And I mean, there were things that Sun did well, and there were things that we learned from, clearly. I mean, taking a step back when we open sourced Java, you know, the first time when we tried to open source it under SCSL, at the time, you know, back in the late 90s, we believed we were open sourcing it. But, and again, we were trying to get ahead of some of these things, and we were definitely thinking about them, not coming up with solutions, but thinking of them and trying to be more proactive. And we were heavily involved in the GPL v3 drafting process. And so at that time, I think it was something that was front of mind. And we were also seeing where the future was going with cloud and thinking, you know, this would also be, you know, very applicable in that space as well. And at HP, where that's where we're seeing it comes up as well, because given such a huge emphasis on cloud computing across the industry, we are seeing this come up more and more again. And not only internally, but again, as we interact with enterprise customers and as I interact with my peers and colleagues from other companies, this seems to be, you know, just top of mind by so many right now.
And Chris, this is maybe in a way jumping ahead chronologically, or maybe not, I'm not sure, but when did you first become aware of AGPL as a kind of policy choice for free software developers? And was it something that you were always, as soon as you heard about it, you were always, that it always appealed to you?
Well, I think that I started to become aware of issues around kind of the proprietization of software by route of doing it via network services in the kind of mid-2000s, which is slightly, like I started to become concerned about it slightly before the Affero General Public License v3 was, I think, announced. At that time, I wasn't really like a developer on any serious free software project, but I was really interested in it. So I was aware of it for quite some time, and at the time that we ended up deciding to create that we started GNU Media Goblin, I thought that the AGPL was kind of the logical choice because I am a big fan of copyleft and of getting and having and the kind of requirements that it provides, and also and I'll also admit that I think that there is a certain amount of at that time there was a lot of discussion that was happening with Autonomo.us and stuff like that and kind of about and there was a lot of excitement, and it seemed like a lot of that excitement in the community, the AGPL was what almost felt like the logical choice. I mean, Evan Prodromos here in the audience, Datasnet was under the AGPL, and like it just seemed like, you know, this is what we should do. So,
actually, Bradley, can you briefly explain what Autonomo.us is or was?
It was an initiative that the FSF was kind of the catalyst behind and helped organize to try and study the question of what it meant to have network services freedom. And I think if you read actually my colleague Richard Stallman's writings on network services, he and I disagree actually about some of the details of when I think network services are harmful. He actually is probably like less radical than I am in some sense, because he sort of believes there are places where you don't really need the source code to a network service you use, for example. But Autonomous was sort of designed as a committee that would explore the question and sort of come up with recommendations about what projects ought to do in addition to licensing. The Affero GPL already existed at the time, but come up with suggestions in addition to licensing and it sort of came up with these ideas that Evan really ran with and Chris is running with to talk about federated services that are connected, and you can move your data and you can move yourself to your own instance of things, because that's important for software freedom, to be able to install your own version and be connected to the rest of your, say, social network, if it's a social network application.
Right, so Autonomous was actually, the concerns of Autonomous were broader than mere licensing, but AGPL was a key part of it.
And on that committee, I was obsessed with the fact that the Affero GPL, maybe naively, that Affero GPL licensing was a central part of the solution. I may have been wrong about that, I'm not sure, but I think it is, I still do believe it is an important component to have a copyleft that thinks toward this software freedom issue, because I came from the think about this question. As soon as Henry sort of began advocating for this at FSF, my big fear became that people, as the internet became ubiquitous, people would say, oh, well, I'll take GCC, I'll modify it on my server, I'll add a bunch of optimizations, and then people will just compile by connecting to the network. If the network's fast enough, you won't notice, and all the optimizations can be proprietary because you're talking to GCC over the network.
Now, that was naive because I had no idea that Apple and Qualcomm were just going to fund a BSD replacement for GCC to try and kill GCC. But that was the kind of thing I was worried about, turning everything into a network service such that users don't have any of their own programs.
So Chris, it's fair to say that autonomous is basically dead as an initiative, and
we were just talking about reviving it in the hallway. Actually.
Okay. Well, so I'll actually sort of give my own view. I mean,
Richard.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Isn't that the biggest threat? Because I was at the open source think tank in Napa last year, and previous years, GPL was good, and in the open source think tank last year, they had Nancy Reagan just say no to the GPL. and I'm an open source developer with AGPL. HP is one of my largest customers. And I was like isolated. We were like three, four people who supported the GPL against the Apache slavery license. Isn't that a big threat that the large corporations will provide alternatives to if you do the
HPL? I think this about yes.
I actually think that actually this somehow this actually does tie in with the question that you're talking about with autonomous. Well, first of all, I don't think that it's absolutely critical that something be under the AGPL. Like, if it's free software and it actually gets things done, I'm still I'm just excited to have network services in some sort of way. But I actually think that AGPL is a really useful part of this solution. And I think the kind of autonomous kind of did die in the sense that, like, there's a lot of excitement, there was a lot of enthusiasm, and it felt at that time like, yeah, we're all going to get geared up, and we're going to like solve all these like network service issues, and we haven't really seen that actually play out in a lot of ways. I think there haven't been as many like initiatives to do things. There haven't been, at least we don't see a lot of people actually doing their things on network services that are free software. And I think that part of the reason why this hasn't happened is, well, we haven't managed to keep up a lot of the excitement and momentum behind autonomous and stuff like that. And I think that it's also true that one of the reasons for this is that there's this kind of attitude that's kind of developed. There's an article that one of the GitHub developers put out that's like, release everything but your secret sauce. You know, like, release everything as, in their own words, open source, except for your secret sauce. And you know, in kind of also the same time that I was that the AGPL was coming out, and I was thinking about a lot of these things, was also around the same time that a lot of kind of the new modern web frameworks were rolling out, like Django and Ruby on Rails and stuff like that. And gaining in popularity. And at that same time, there was also kind of a large, I think, pushback against copyleft. A number of the big leaders on those projects, you know, were kind of had a pushback against copyleft. Famously, David DHH, I can never remember his full name, of Rails is not a fan of copyleft. Same with Jacob Kaplan-Moss of Django is very visibly, vocally anti-Django, anti-AGPL, not anti his own project. But I think that, and that's had a lot of effect. But one of the interesting aspects of this, I think, is that we're seeing actually more free software being released around web service, around web development stuff than ever before in some ways, but it's actually being released in this kind of everything but your secret sauce way, right?
Well, I mean, OpenStack's kind of an example of that.
OpenStack,
it's a Apache
yes.
license with lots of proprietary forks.
But the reason for the...
Including HP's proprietary fork.
I think the reason for Apache, though, if you talk to the folks who contributed to that, were XBase and the government, it was largely done to gain adoption. In other words, there was this consensus building at that time that, you know, in order to gain adoption, the widespread adoption, you need to do Apache. And there was also, I know you don't agree with this, but statistically, I think they were reading those statistics and seeing that, you know, more and more projects are going the Apache route and kind of looking behind that. in the thought that you can actually build a vibrant community with a permissive license.
Yeah. I only disagree with the second part. The first part, I think you're absolutely correct. It's always been, when you look at the permissive to copyleft spectrum, it's always been a spectrum that also maps to adoption versus software freedom.
Yes.
And a lot of people in the web services space are making that decision. And the other point I want to make about that is if you put like a Faro here and GPL here and permissive here, in web services space, this whole part collapses because GPL and Apache are basically the same in web services space. So you either have a Faro or everything else.
You're right, if you look at it from that perspective. I see, in the simplistic way of just looking at it from that point, because the distribution piece, you're right.
If we broaden this term web, whatever term you just used.
I used a term poorly, probably. So go ahead.
It's interesting that you mentioned OpenStack, because I gave a talk at, Eileen invited me to talk at the OpenStack Summit last fall, and I gave a talk about why I thought OpenStack was an interesting project, sort of post-2007 project, given all the things that had happened historically in free software and open source since then. And, you know, looking back at the origins of OpenStack, OpenStack was partly a reaction against the open core business model of Eucalyptus.
Because they were targeting the
choice of the Apache license was actually a statement, a political statement, if you will.
Yeah, it was.
Against the way that GPLv3 was being used by Martin Mikos.
Yes.
And so, you know,
because he did the same thing with MySQL with GPLv2, but also asserting on the website this is pre-Sun's acquisition of MySQL, but he asserted that if you wanted used it for commercial purposes, you needed to. I mean, at least there was that insinuation that you needed to then pay for the license.
Right, and so it may sound like we're kind of getting a little off topic, but we're actually not, because the thing that I see, and I suspect no one on this panel will disagree with me, but if you do, please say so. I see post 2007, there's very little adoption of AGPL by what I think of as pure community projects. Much of the use of AGPL I have encountered in my time at Red Hat has been used by basically proprietary software companies or proprietary network service provider companies, that sort of thing, proprietary SaaS companies, where basically they will put a community edition under the AGPL. So this is a variant of the model that Eucalyptus had at that time. I guess it's a little different now, where Eucalyptus was using the GPL. So. That much of the use of AGPL has been, you know, in this proprietary, what Bradley calls proprietary relicensing, what some of us think of as dual licensing or open core. And so I'm wondering if the people on the panel think
there's a question.
Bradley is going to hate me, but can I share my reason why I switched to the AGPL?
Yes, can I actually ask what project you're talking
about? iText.
I thought so.
Yeah.
Now let me point out that iText is banned from Fedora and JBoss because you're not using the AGPL. You're adding a restriction on AGPL that's illegitimate.
What's the restriction?
A watermark requirement. So that is not. Yeah, you're actually part of the problem.
Yeah.
Let me elaborate on the reason why I changed. So iText was initially released under the LGPL in 2000. And then a couple of years later, I added the MPL because the industry didn't like the LGPL, so they wanted the MPL because it was more understandable for lawyers.
So
it was MPL, LGPL, and I thought, no money, no worries.
Since you don't actually use the AGPL for your software, I'm going to cut you off.
In response to Richard's point about proprietary licensing, I mentioned this morning one thing that not much keeps me up at night because I feel like I'm doing the right thing for the world, but this is yet another thing that keeps me up at night. The fact that I helped create a license, the Afero GPL, that's primarily used in this basically corrupt business model of trying to trick people. And I think when I hear a lot of, Eileen has a lot of concerns about the text of AGPL and making sure that you can comply correctly. And I guess, Eileen's never told me this, but my guess is, and she probably can't tell us because it's probably NDA, but she probably runs into these kinds of companies who are using the Afero GPL, which means, from HP's perspective, you have to be really careful because they're trying to trick you into violating the license so they can force you to buy a proprietary license. That's what proprietary licensing is about. And that's a corrupt use of Afero GPL.
There's two variants. One is that Mr. I don't actually know how to pronounce your Luigi. What you do is actually you didn't mention that you have a proprietary business model. So you require As I recall, you require users to put this watermark.
It's not a watermark, and we changed after we had a mail discussion. We had a lawyer look at it, and he changed the wording. So according to the IP lawyer, it's no.
It's still legitimate and still banned from JBoss and Fedora and Opera. So this is a big problem. You've misused this license that I helped draft and that Bradley helped draft. And the other kind of what I think of as a misuse or an unintended use is the more standard.
And this is why Chris and Evan are my heroes, because they're two projects using the Affera GPL as basically towards drafter's intent.
Right.
And so the questions we get into are in some ways academic, in the sense that, you know, when I'm working with other companies and they have questions about it, my point is to try to educate them and explain what it means. However, we've talked about this, Richard. There's some ambiguity which causes concern. And it's really around the modification of what that means. And I find it. Sometimes I get involved with these discussions and education sessions with lawyers who are fairly savvy in open source, and sometimes it's enterprise customers who don't have a whole lot of open source experience. So if they're looking at the strict contractual document, they're looking at this and trying to understand exactly what it means, and so that they can comply with it. And again, I'm dealing with sometimes with customers and companies. I know I've talked to some peers and colleagues out there with other companies, and there are companies out there who have bans on AGPL. So that's something that I've encountered as well.
Yeah, so that's sort of a separate issue, because that's why I had the text up here.
Yes, because of this.
Because this is an...
I think actually we're starting to move over to the concerns about, like, you know, like the company's concerns of the AGPL and, like, whether or not things are adopting. But I think that there's one thing I want to get back to, which is related to the OpenStack and et cetera issue of things, which was the... I think that there's an important point that should be... That I've observed is that I think one of the reasons we haven't seen that much AGPL adoption is also because we still aren't seeing many applications releasing their end product of things. Like most of the projects that we see, even though we have a large amount of web-related software being released, most of that software being released is actually stuff that's infrastructure.
Frameworks, libraries.
Yes, frameworks, yes, exactly. Libraries. OpenStack is mostly something
exactly
used to people's
infrastructure. Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
But not many people are actually releasing web applications. And I think that this is an important point, because on the primary place where GPL is used, even on someone's own server, like on a desktop or et cetera, we see tons of GPL adoption as in terms of applications, but not much as in terms of libraries. Now, And I'm not going to get into the Los Angeles General Public License LAGPL thing, but still, I think that's an important distinction, and part of that might actually be related to that there's just not enough momentum that we have at the moment towards getting people excited about building those types of things right now. But anyway, I wanted to return to that before we move.
Actually,
forward.
I kind of have a question for you, because you're talking about how what does modify mean, and see the weird thing is it sounds to me like the question I always get about GPL is what is a derivative work, and my answer always is, well, it's whatever copyright law determines it, and obviously it should go as far as it goes.
Look at the definition.
But it says it's based around modify. I mean, Eileen even said the modify is the issue, but modify is the word we get from the copyright
statute.
But
it says modify, and then your modified version must, you know.
Yeah.
So the questions we get around this language. Now, one of the things that we talked about in our prep call, which I think was really important as well, is we talked about the fact that, you know, in general, we look at GPL v2, and if we go back in, you know, 10, 15 years ago, we had a lot of questions about GPL v2 at the time, and what did that mean, and what is it, you know, what did it mean to distribute? And these questions came up in that context. I think part of the reason that I think I'm seeing more questions right now are because there aren't as many projects under AGPL v2 yet, so we're not seeing as many v3. We're not seeing as many sort of use cases and test cases, and there's that level of comfort when you have much more significant use, and you sort of know what it means. You've got a community, and the other thing is, you know, we talked about FAQs. There's some FAQs on the website, FSF website, around certain aspects of this, and maybe what we could do is, you know, enhance those and increase, you know, add some things around modification, what have you. But again, I think part of it is once we have more use, that will start to flesh out as well, and there'll be more comfort. But it takes time.
But I think it would have to be use by other than the kind of use we've often been seeing.
Yes.
Which is, Bruno, I'm afraid, I think of you as an example of this as a problem where we see the notion that preservation of a watermark, that as an additional condition on AGPL. Well, whatever. That can be a legitimate way that AGPL can be used, or there may be other companies that are using AGPL to promote sales of proprietary licenses,
right,
where
yeah,
they have an incentive to kind of
yeah.
exaggerate, yeah. since there's this yeah. absence of community interpretive consensus, mm-hmm. there is an incentive for these commercial entities that are really motivated to sell proprietary licenses to kind of have more restrictive.
Right. I'll slightly belabor.
Business model behind the AGPL, or there is no business model.
Basically, the business model of free software is to make sure all your customers have equal software freedom. And if your goal is to use a license to catch them in a violation and force them to buy a proprietary license, or if you're developing a forked proprietary version, that's not a free software business model. And the fact that copyleft helps those business models promulgate, that troubles me. And the fact that FaroGPL's default use is to promulgate those business models, I think it confuses the issue completely. Because if all the projects were just GNU Media Goblin-like, we'd be having a very different discussion. We'd be having a much similar discussion that we had in the GPL2 days.
Or if the business models, and the only business model that works for you as a developer is become an employee. And that's the only business model that works if you want to write AGPL. So.
All right.
Chris is a living counterexample of that.
Well, I'm an employee of the internet since I'm crowdfunded.
Right, yeah. That's a joke. And the thing is you're being funded to work on something that gets everything
free. I mean, I actually think there's a number of ways that you can make that you can fund free software for network services. One of them is you know, running hosted instances of things. One of them, which, you know, maybe is, but there's another one of them is doing things through grant work or through crowdfunding. I mean, I think that there's other funding
and
options.
And healthy volunteer contribution, which is central. I think GNU Media Goblin has volunteers.
Well, we have a very strong volunteer base. I actually think that, you know, and maybe at this point, you know, one thing we should be saying here is if this is an issue that concerns you, a great way to deal with this is get directly involved with the project and help develop, if you're concerned about this, help grow the base of strong AGPL projects. I actually think one of the things we said on the call when we were talking about this was about, you know, the difference between like GPL v2 adoption. There's a lot of concerns that are raised about the AGPL, and there are actually some concerns that, you know, I've pestered you and the FSF and
yeah.
plenty of people about. And there are things that I'd like to discuss more. But I think that a lot of there might even be some issues that like maybe would be helped with better exceptions or et cetera. But a lot of adoption is probably not just based on whether or not the license is entirely perfect. Because, you know, as you've given talks before about GPL v2, incredibly popular license, right?
Yeah, but it's not
a perfect license.
It has a lot of flaws, but it was popular because it developers reacted to it. Developers wanted to choose it, and developers as volunteers and for their side projects, they aren't choosing a FaroGPL, and so we sort of don't have that situation. I'm committed to writing the lesser FaroGPL. I think it's a license we need, just like we need the lesser GPL. But I don't think going back and trying to fix I agree with you, Eileen, completely. There's probably bugs in that language. It's probably not perfect. But I haven't seen a compelling case that if we just fix this license, there would be tons more developers writing a FaroGPL software. And without that case, I'm going to focus on something like writing a lesser AGPL.
To bring this back to what we were talking about before, is it that the developers who would be, I mean, I guess, Chris, you kind of answered this. The developers who would be working on AGPL applications are instead working on proprietary web service applications and maybe also working on non-copyleft frameworks and libraries and so forth? Or, are we seeing a use of GPL where we would expect to see AGPL by now? If we, you know, turn back the clock and
I actually don't see that. In terms of web services, I don't see that much GPL adoption these days.
That's that collapse.
But I think that I'm trying to understand the scope of the question. Are you asking that one of the reasons why AGPL isn't being adopted because there's a lack of momentum, or is it because of perceived issues in the license, or is it because of community?
Well, we kind of conflated this issue of non-adoption of AGPL with the this notion that copyleft itself is in decline, particularly among web developers, developers of sort of cloud-oriented projects. And are those, I mean, I think those two are somewhat, they're somewhat distinct.
I think it's reasonable we conflated them because I think they're somehow related. I can't put my finger on exactly how they are, but I think it's related.
Well, I think, I think it has to do with a couple of things. Well, one, just that there isn't a lot of momentum right now behind AGPL adoption, but two, also because I think, as you said, I think that more stuff is just being developed as in terms of web services right now than any other type of software. And so we're not seeing a large uptick in GPL software either, probably because I think most software that's being written is moving towards this direction.
Well, certainly things that companies contribute to.
This is
a slightly off topic, but sort of related to the point of your fundraising, how you got your project funded. Free software used to be written primarily by volunteers. If you go back 15 years, 20 years, that's how almost all of it was written.
Yeah, now it's funded by most companies
and developers, individual developers. It used to be the case. Right, yes. But it used to be the case that developers would write proprietary software during the day and come home and give back to free software projects and write free software on their nights and weekends.
Right.
I think a lot of developers have an I gave at the office, somewhat reasonably so, kind of mentality. All my code at work was released as free software. Why should I go home and write more volunteer work? And I think that's related
because
I think it's important to put that in context. I think, at least in the US, and I can only really speak to that, people work longer hours for less money. And so if you go home and do more free work, it's harder and harder for people to carve out. I don't think it's like a flagging interest in giving back to the community. I think it's just you have a finite number of hours in the day. And, not everyone has the option to carve out enough volunteer time to give to the projects that they feel more strongly about than whatever they do at work.
Well, the United Way says, if everybody gave 2% of their income or time to the causes they care about, they would change, the world would change completely.
And I think that's
true.
So
we have somebody who's got
the pasta organizer.
Yeah.
Please.
Thank you very much. I have one question. Do you have any statistics on the difference between the GPL-3 adoption and the AGPL version 3 adoption?
So I know.
This is about the difference, but do you have some statistics about it?
When I looked at Fedora, I think it was Fedora 16. Fedora 16 official packages, so it's about 18,000 packages, was about 11% GPL-v3, from what I recall, and maybe 1% or less AGPL. And in fact, some of that was Gluster, and Gluster changed its license before Red Hat acquired it.
But I think a big part of it is it's clear, the distribution piece of it is very, very clear in GPL, across GPL v2 and v3. So again, it's a clear delineation. If you're giving someone software, you sort of know when the license is triggered.
Right.
I think that's another piece too that's a little bit, that is new under AGPL.
I understand what you're saying,
yes.
But my argument would be that that this section, it links to the derivative work issue more than it links to the distribution issue. And therefore, it's as confusing in some sense as derivative work. We're having constant arguments
about that too.
Right, we're having because it's modified, which is creating a
yes.
derivative work, preparing
right.
and creating
but
derivative
but the,
works.
The piece about when is it triggered and what is that? Those are all the questions I get around section 13.
But those indeed it is, of
yes.
course.
Yes.
But the questions only come up because their goal is not to give upstream, right? So
right.
they want to know when
sometimes
they don't have to give upstream.
But sometimes it's just internally they need to understand what it is so that they can, oftentimes I'm dealing with corporate legal departments, right? So they need to understand what it is so they can kind of check the box. But you made a good point earlier, which I want to go back to, Bradley, which is in the GPL v2, the whole, I think the distribution thing and that we've been living with it for so long, I think is incredibly helpful here. So a lot of, and I know GPL v3 modified and changed certain things in GPL v2, clearly it did. However, I think by and large, we've got a lot of comfort around that license. And again, you're right about the, I agree with you too. But most of the use I see with AGPL v2 is, v3 is this nefarious use. Until we have, some use out there, until we have consistency,
right.
use, then we're gonna, I think, then get some comfort around
it. Stack is issues that get conflated there because there's the issue that the derivative works question is still a hotly debated in the GPL, regular GPL space,
yeah.
and then we're using this new clause as linked to that rather than
yeah.
distribution,
yeah.
A, and then B, there's the adoption question I think you're completely right about, then C, there's the nefarious use as we're
yeah.
calling it.
So,
yeah.
All
so,
of these
so
come together to sort of
to
conspire.
Solve the problem by ignoring the problem maker.
So you've already commented a few times already.
Bradley, is there? Do you think that there's an argument that there's a special problem with AGPL in terms of determining the scope of how much source code you have to provide because there isn't that, you don't have this binary that you can then work backwards from? Because I think that's maybe some of what the kind of commercial resistance that Eileen encounters and that I've encountered a little bit, that some of that is based on that.
I know.
Even apart from the nefarious business models, I think some of it is the concern about this language about modify, what does that mean, and section 13. I think some of it is how do you figure out the scope issue if there's nothing distributed? Is that a fundamental problem with AGPL, or is it something that's solvable through?
I don't think it's a fundamental problem with AGPL. I think the details are more complicated for most people because they're different. Because it's basically a different type of deployment in some sense. So we already have trouble people agreeing what is the binary and what is the corresponding source of the binary. That's what most GPL violators fail on and fight on. So there is a wrinkle added with the Afero clause, because now you have to decide what is the work that was presented to the user. For example, now everybody's going to run and not want to use the Afero GPL. I'm pretty sure that if you're using Mod Python, that your Python program is probably derivative work of Mod Python, which means you have to ship the complete and corresponding source of the Afero GPL program includes the Mod Python code. I think that's probably true.
Chris, do you agree with that?
So, well, I don't know if I want to touch that one, but I think that actually, though, that there is a related thing where, so we're talking about adoption, and also it's interesting that right now we're talking about both adoption and concerns, and Eileen, you're mostly talking about concerns from a business point of view, and there's also been concerns sometimes that are raised within the community point of view, like, for example, in the media goblin community. And I think there's two things. One, there are some things that, like, I'd love to have more clarification on. For example, media goblin, I think our community would, for the most part, not like to have to worry about people releasing templates and theming under the same type of conditions as they have normally under the AGPL. Because if a company wants to come and run their own media goblin instance and they want to just make it look like the rest of their site, we're like, fine, we really don't care about that licensing aspect of things. And at one point we were trying to look to see whether or not that there was an exception that we could end up having, which was about whether or not we could just say, okay, well, except everything in the exceptions is totally, you don't have to worry about it. But the problem that we ran into there was, you could possibly end up generating a loophole where you could say, well, you could end up inserting a Python function into the context and then execute arbitrary code, and by that method end up using the template as a way to get around copyleft. And so, like, this is a tricky thing, and I'd actually like to find a way that we could resolve both of those without having some sort of loophole, but I'm actually not sure that, but I actually think that there's, as in terms of the adoption issue, I think that the only way to solve the adoption issue is to both simultaneously get a bunch of people excited in writing these types of applications and then try to end up looking at whether the concerns of developers who end up adopting it at that time.
But how do you do it? So this is, I think, what I wanted to ask before, but I forgot. Has there been just a cultural change among developers?
Moderator, do you want to get the question? There's hands up over here.
Sorry, moderatee.
Yeah.
guy in the back who's had his hand up for a while.
My issue with modification is that I don't think the problem is that...
Speak up just a little bit.
If I modify the thing, I'm willing to share the source code, but my problem with a lot of AGPL programs is that there's no built-in functionality to share the source code.
Oh, that's a wonderful comment. I couldn't agree with you more, and I had this idea of creating what I was calling libafero GPL for various languages, which would basically, and you could do things like introspection to build this, right? And it would basically, if you include this library, it would always make sure there's the source package on the website. And this is actually, it's not like NP complete to solve, right? It's not such a hard problem. It's really a lot of grunt work and and complexity. But in part because of the adoption issue, it's hard to sort of get the momentum behind, let's make a library that automatically complies. Because Evan and I think we talked about this at one point about for StatusNet, that there really should be this thing that Chris could link against, right? And GNU Media Goblin would always be in compliance. Because a lot of complaints I've heard about a Faro GPL is accidental out of compliance. And it's actually, I admit, it's easier to get accidentally out of compliance on a Faro GPL than it is under GPL. And so I'd love to have this library that sort of takes care of some of those compliance issues for you. But somebody's got to write that.
So is this the idea you had a long time ago about Fedora packaging?
Yeah, it was from Tom Calloway's comments. Is Tom in the room? Guess not. So, but he had those comments about how do you stay in compliance with AGPL, and I thought this should be an automated way to do it.
But you also had an idea for how Fedora should adopt a packaging rule for AGPL packages.
Yeah, it was part and parcel. It's I don't want to get into the details, okay. but it was the same kind of solution.
Yeah, so, the guy in the front was had his hand for a
yeah,
while.
Yeah, sorry.
You talk about AGPL and people who add additional conditions on it. I thought the license said explicitly that if you receive software that says it's only AGPL, and the parents say, oh, and you must do this, and the user can just like, oh, I'm not going to do this because they get say a lot.
True, in theory, but it's difficult in practice because what if, as we just had here, a disagreement? We have a legitimate disagreement here. One person saying no, it's not an additional restriction, and the other person saying yes, it is. So, and that's complicated.
So let me explain this. In GPLv3, Richard Stallman came up with an interesting idea of because he was aware of this problem under the GPL, people would put no military use allowed or no commercial use allowed on top of the GPL. So Stallman said, why don't we add a clause that says if someone puts an unauthorized additional restriction on the program, you can just remove it. Well, no one's actually really done this because
in those cases, right? In those no military use, because everybody sort of has consensus it contradicts. But I think it's a borderline.
That software is just avoided. I think people are understandably afraid to just cross out a condition that the licensor added. You know, we could do that with Bruno's software. And Bruno, this is not licensed to speak anymore. But we could do that with Bruno's software, but my point is,
I'm actually, Bruno, I'm on your side on this one. My point is that Bruno disagrees with you. Bruno's saying it's not an additional restriction, and you're saying that it is, and only a court would decide if Red Hat and this company sued each other or something, right? So that's the issue, is that if we have a legitimate disagreement of what is an additional restriction, it's really complicated, and that's one of the reasons that hasn't been exercised very much.
But it's not, in his case, it's not even a legitimate, there's no legitimate argument that's authorized under Section 7.
Ali, what do you think? Yeah.
I think we've got more questions on this side as well.
Yes.
Go ahead. Me?
Yes.
First generation of copyleft software.
Evan, you should say who you are. Because
my name's Evan Pedromo. I created software called StatusNet, which is HTTPL licensed. It runs Identica, which many of you may use. First generation of copyleft software, we were holding kind of the crown jewels of the Unix world, right? So Bash, GCC, Emacs, eventually the Linux kernel. We don't right now, right? So especially in the world of web publishing, I think those crown jewels might be WordPress, Drupal. I will say very humbly that it is not StatusNet. To what extent do you think that a lack of AGPL adoption is just that we haven't written the absolutely necessary software that nobody can do without?
I think that's really an excellent point. I think you might be onto something there because you're right. I think something like that will then drive that. In some ways, get other folks on board and they would have to get their heads around it and get comfortable with it. I think that's an excellent point.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree that I think that's one of the main thing that we're lacking as in terms of that is, I mean, again, it comes back to the, you know, everybody releasing stuff except for their secret sauce thing, is that we have a lot of corporations and a lot of companies and a lot of developers participating in releasing really cool stuff, but we don't see a lot of applications. I actually think that if we did, going back to the Fedora comment about how much a percentage of do we see AGPL in Fedora, but how much also do we see percentage in AGPL of end product web application projects, actual web applications, and we just don't see very much of it.
It's true.
And if it, you know, Emacs itself, would not have been a
I think Evan, you touched on a very cultural point. I look at somebody like myself who is obsessed somewhat with this issue, and I believe in web service freedom. But when I look at the, I don't get to code very much. But when I look at the list of things I want to do, I've got like 7 patches for Bash I want to write.
Yeah.
Right, and because I've used Bash all day, I don't use many web services because I'm an old school command line Unix jockey geek, right? And so there's a cultural mismatch that I think the copyleft and the old school Unix type overlap a lot, and so they're less likely to write these applications. That's why we need people like you and Chris to do it, who actually get this web stuff, because I'm like a Luddite.
There's a person in the back who's had his hand up. Yeah.
Just wondering your thoughts on structural questions related to web services. When you consider, you know, the structure and scale it kind of takes to get the amount of hardware to get something like a Twitter scale end user application off the ground, it suggests venture capitalism funding. And I doubt VCs generally approve of the AGPL, particularly given the secret sauce argument, how new it is, and that seems to prevent, you know, further basic applications.
I'm dying to just ask Evan to answer this question. I think he's the expert on the room on the issue.
I have raised venture capital based on an AGPL project that is similar to Twitter.
Thank you. Woo! Thank you.
Question was for me. And I can just say really quickly, there have been lots of commercial projects that have done well with AGPL. And
not only that, you raised it and you stayed pure AGPL and you bound yourself by AGPL in the sense that you accepted patches from third parties.
Yes, I did.
You regret that decision, though, you said.
Huh?
Do you regret that decision?
That is a discussion for another time.
Okay.
I think that from a commercial standpoint, because of the nefarious use from the sugar CRMs of the world that are using AGPL, impossible to get funding for it.
But I still think that it's also, I guess there's another flip side of that too, which is also that. It's also hard to build web applications that are both designed to scale up to the moon and also kind of down and in the middle. That's also a completely different discussion, so I'll shut my mouth.
Well, part of it is development's become harder than it used to be as far as what you have to get done to make something innovative.
Right.
The person in the black and white sort of checkered shirt.
So I would just like to try to add to Evan's argument that maybe adoption is also limited by the fact that most web applications that are built and are either Apache license or free software are not actually decentralized. So maybe the developers actually, of course, subconsciously or outright, they can say that, okay, it doesn't really matter because what matters is the network effect. So in the end, we'll have to run a central site anyway. And the other issue I would like to also mention is that, with the binary, you can basically verify that you have the source, and I mean, it's not easy, but at least
it's soft topic, but we should talk about it. It's not as easy as you think.
I'm in that field, so okay. I'm aware of the restrictions.
That's an issue I wanted to actually raise, with Bradley or Chris. How would you determine compliance with the AGPL?
Oh, well, Bradley and I are probably very different on this. I'm like lazy compliance, but I'm not taking the legal route entirely. What I mean, as in terms of our project, what I really care about is that somebody demonstrates that they've pushed out their source for their project and that they've made it available and that the community can take it and bring it back to that. Now, I think part of the issue is making that really, having a really clear, way that we have it resolved the Media Goblin is there is a source link that links back to the Media Goblin main repository, and if you've changed and you have a branch, you're supposed to change an argument in the config file so that you actually point to where you currently have your code pushed up. That's a really lazy way to do it. The there's, you know, you've talked about, you know, your the full-on library, which I think would be a great solution if we had it. It also doesn't really help with the argument that, oh, AGPL adoption
is
that hard.
Well, I mean, making things easier. But see, my argument would be actually very similar to what I said on the panel this morning, that if your goal is to find the minimal compliance, if your goal is to say, what do I minimally have to do to comply with the affair of AGPL, probably it's hard with GPL. But if your goal is, I want to make everything available, and my goal is to be a free software developer and share all my code, compliance is relatively easy. Now, I've said a couple of problems what we have with Affero GPL.
I just wanted to interrupt. What I meant actually was, how do you detect a violation?
No.
Well, that's always difficult if somebody's trying. It's again the answer
isn't
I gave this morning.
More, isn't it more difficult with AGPL, and could that be a factor in limiting uptake?
Well, see, I always complain when people opine about compliance who've never done enforcement, because the only things I know about compliance come from years of enforcement experience, and it really informs it. So I've never done a Affero GPL enforcement, so I don't feel qualified to answer.
I doubt.
Evan has, I think. Yeah. You've done some AGPL. How did you find out about that violator in China?
We've done a couple of enforcement efforts, and you know, largely it's visible through the behavior of the service, so what people spend time on. That said, there may have been thousands of violators that I don't know about, because they made changes, say, to a very back-end process that's invisible to the user.
I think he wants to tell us we didn't answer his question, because I don't think we did.
Yeah. So actually, I didn't finish my argument and pose a question.
Okay.
With regard to stuff like Gmail, is I would say that this search isn't really useful, even if we had it. It's something that's pretty massive, nobody can run it on themselves. It's useful to know how it works, but that could even just be done by a pyramid that describes how it works. So keeping that in mind, my question would be, like, is the AGPL the right tool for this issue? Isn't it more of a technical issue than a licensing, something that can be solved with licensing?
Yeah. So I think that this is actually a really important point. And it's like, it's one of those things where you're right, it's not just, the licensing isn't gonna magically fix these problems. And like one of the big things, and I mean, I guess, you know, we keep pointing to Evan in the audience, you know, the main innovator in the audience along the lines of this is Evan trying to help figure out, you know, how do we get actual federation working? Federation, I think, is a big part of solving this. If it were, federation and deployment, actually, because if it were easy enough, and I will say if it was as easy, not to say it's easy, as installing a package on your Debian machine, like, you know, like if you're to install Media Goblin or another web application, if it were that easy and you had federation, we could solve a lot of this problem, because a lot of the things is it's really hard to install and maintain web applications. Like, you install them, they, like, you know, you've got to deal with net migrations, you've got to do all this. It's a pain in the ass.
So I would say that to say it in a science way, the Affero GPL is a necessary but not sufficient condition for network services freedom. You need a license that protects the freedom of the network service, but we need a lot more than that. And you're right to raise federation, you're right to raise distributed environments, but those are very difficult computer science problems to solve, so we have to do that too.
I would just point out very quickly that so if you actually have a distributed system where everyone is actually running it on their servers, then the GPL might just be enough.
Right, but the thing is, you need both together. That was my point. You need a distributed environment. So, oh, I see what you're saying. That's an interesting point. I have to think about that.
I think we have time for just one more question. Zach.
So, Bradley made the point, the cultural point, that essentially we free software geeks are more using like a local standalone application on our machine than web services. So we have less interest in solving kind of problem on the web. But we do have today a lot of people developing web apps. I think today, developing stuff for the web is the way a lot of people start developing. Mm-hmm. So yes. What worries me, and it's an open question, I think, for you and the panel, is that why the free software arguments that were very powerful for us as standalone developers are not as powerful for the today's generation of web developers?
Yeah.
It's kind of a straw man. I mean, it's not...
I tell you, these kids today...
But they're growing Japanese.
Well, okay. So you're getting old.
part of the thing is we've, in a certain sense, failed to engage, and we failed to engage for a long time.
Yeah.
For a long time, free software was like, it's that person's computer. It doesn't really matter what's running on that server. It's their computer. This isn't a huge issue. But it does matter, and now we're being forced to acknowledge it really matters, and we're late to the game. So what we really need to do now is get involved in those communities and have a presence and actually start pushing things forward. Because I think that yeah, it's not enough. I mean,
but if you look at what a lot of the developers are doing too, I can't remember which one of you made it on the prep call, but again, they're working on projects that are more patchy, more permissive style licensing. And again, we got to take a step back from that and see why that is. But we are seeing that significant trend for the younger generation of developers as well. And part of it is these projects are coming out under these licenses, these new hot projects.
It has both to do with, it's easy on your job to be able to contribute to something
that's
the other thing is that when you end up developing an application, you know, when I came into developing and picking up the AGPL, I only knew so much about the AGPL. I knew enough about the AGPL to have the general idea behind it. I didn't think about templating issues at that time. But you know, like I keep pointing to Evan, you know, was one of my heroes. You know, one of the reasons I adopted the AGPL is because, you know, somebody else was doing something and I looked up to them. Who are developers looking up to today? They're looking up to the Rails developers, they're looking up to the Django developers, and those people have an anti-copyleft stance. And when your heroes end up taking some sort of stance, it's, you know,
You tend to follow,
and it's not because people are malicious.
No.
It's because we haven't done a good enough job creating a role model that explains why these things matter.
And when you look at our the leader of the copyleft world, Richard Stallman, he did it in two ways. He had a moral position that he was trying to push forward, but he wrote a lot of code.
Exactly.
Right.
That everybody wanted to use and couldn't live without.
Which I think was to Evan's point, because again, it was that cultural thing. And so, Deb had a question in the front.
Deb, and I think after Deb's question, we're out of time.
This is just a short comment on the adoption process. I think another thing that's different besides age is that if you're writing something to be part of a distribution, then you're part of that team, and you don't want to be the jerk that's like, I chose a different license than the rest of the team. But on the web, it's like a bazillion teams. So you're just like an individual person. And then you have the burden of sorting through a bunch of legalese, which most people don't like to do. So if everyone's doing their own legal, and they don't feel like they're part of a team that's made that decision for them, I think it makes it more difficult to choose.
So I think we need Team AGPL. I mean, the same way that we have that the reason why GPL v2 was so strongly adopted was because we had basically Team GPL v2, which was just people were doing that because they looked up to various people who are on the desktop. We need to have, you know, Team AGPL. And
but Jeff's got a good point, because I think even lawyers are confused, and we have to go grapple back and forth with language. So, I mean, you raise a good point, Deb. I think you're up.
But lawyers would learn to live with it if there was code that they absolutely couldn't live without.
Just like GPLv2.
We are being kicked out of the room, so we are out of time.
Thank you.
I've got Media Goblin stickers.
So I thought that Fontana was a really good moderator.
I think he did a reasonably good job. He probably should have not kept referencing that audience member. And yeah, I towards the end of the panel, folks will notice, I felt like I had to defend that side of his point somewhat, because he was getting such a hard time that we kept going back to him and referencing his company and so forth. So I didn't like that I had to actually defend, because I'm against the business model as well of proprietary relicensing, but we had to keep going back to it because Fontana wanted to engage him on that point, I guess, to sort of show what the problem was. I don't know. That part of it was not very good, I thought, but the rest of it I think was good.
Well, I remembered that when I left, but it actually didn't seem like as big of a deal as you had described it when I was listening to it again.
Okay. Well, I felt it was. I didn't feel like it was the. It was. There was not enough moderation.
Huh. Oh, I see what you. I'm sorry.
Yeah, because
it's kind of late here.
Yeah, well, Fontana was engaging with him, and I actually think there's some sort of backstory there. It seemed to me like there was a Red Hat dispute with that company that was part of the backstory. That was my feeling.
I wonder.
Yeah, I wondered about it too. He didn't talk. I don't know anything from Fontana about it, but I think there was something there. Maybe they were a customer of that company or something like that.
We should ask Richard Fontana.
He wouldn't tell me anything. I already asked him.
I should hope not.
Yeah. But that's what it felt like to me from that engagement. So I think the key thing that I wanted people to hear was what Chris Weber had to say, because I feel like the thing, and that's why I said in the panel that he's a hero to me, because he's trying to write these applications that use Affero GPL and try to treat users well. And he's one of the very few developers who's working in that way as a community project, trying to create online applications that are free software and hopefully federated, although that's a tougher problem to solve, as we talked about.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's the biggest challenge we always have with free software, actually, is building alternatives. I mean, it's so frustrating, you know, to be an advocate for free software where there are areas where we just don't have great alternatives. It's just, it's really tough to, you know, I mean, yeah, it's just really tough to be an advocate when there's nothing that you can point to. And, you know, I think you and I agree that a little inconvenience is worthwhile, you know, is worth it for free software, but it's tough to get other people who are not already involved with the cause to see that.
It's that give me convenience or give me death issue that I'm always talking about from that title of that Dead Kennedys album. People are much, very much willing to give up lots of things just for a little bit of convenience. And that really troubles me, because it means that there's this interest. And that's the danger of things like Facebook, because they've reached so many people. And it is proprietary software. And this is the interesting thing, is that the issues of online services are more complicated as far as free and proprietary software. I even said on the panel that Stallman and I it's funny, because here these months later, Stallman's actually working on another essay about this topic, and he and I have been in a discussion about it.
Oh, you and your colleague, Richard Stallman?
Yes, Richard Stallman. why do you say it like that?
No, just because you said on the panel, you said... you referred to RMS as quote my colleague Richard Stallman, quote unquote, as if or unquote, as if people wouldn't know who he was.
No, I just wanted to make it clear that I'm on the FSF board and therefore he's my colleague. That's to pump myself up, obviously. Not to say that they wouldn't know who he was, but that you know, he's a guy that, just as is happening right now, emails me and sends me. We talked about this on the Oddcast a couple episodes ago, that he does send his essays around before he publishes them and asks for feedback. And on this network services essay, he sent it to me and Mako and Chris Weber and a bunch of other people who have worked on the net services issue. And when we're discussing the nuances of net service issues, but the thing that we always agree on, I see it as kind of a shortcut, which is that most of these network services deliver to the browser, and most of the JavaScript is all proprietary software. In fact, nearly all of the JavaScript is proprietary in all the usual senses of proprietariness. So it's kind of funny because people talk about, oh, it's a different issue with network services, which RMS himself says. But mm-hmm. when it's proprietary JavaScript, it's the same issue. It's software being distributed to your computer and installed on your computer that's proprietary. It's the same as saying apt-get install something proprietary. There's no discernible difference.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. But I would say that even if you weren't on the FSF board, you could refer to him as your colleague.
Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Anyway, so that's...
And I would actually, you know, in my view, I think Skype is a bit more of a pervasive, insidious piece of proprietary software.
More so than Facebook? Because there's a lot more people on Facebook than using Skype.
The nature of the software is such that I just feel like it's even more insidious. I mean, I don't know. Facebook is pretty insidious in a lot of different ways, but its nature feels a little, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny that this comes up.
Alternatives to point.
Sorry. Well, there is a delay here, which we just showed, but it is funny that this comes up at a moment when we're doing the recording this way, because we're talking to we're each recording locally to get a good audio quality for Dan to do the editing, but we're talking to each other over a fully encrypted link from here in Brooklyn, New York, all the way to where are you, in Tokyo now?
I'm in Tokyo.
Right, so we've got a setup that all it did was basically an apt-get install asterisk, a few additions to apt-get install OpenVPN, configuration of OpenVPN, a brief configuration of asterisk, and then here Karen and I are talking to each other using SIP across a fully encrypted OpenVPN. So while it did require a server in the middle that we had to set up, this is not that it's not that hard, and I've written blog posts about this, that how it really isn't that hard to encrypt to do encrypted end-to-end phone calls, and there's really nobody working on it to help people to do it, and it's kind of unfortunate, but people want that convenience of, oh, I just installed the proprietary Microsoft Skype client and now I can talk to people, and so I see what you're saying about
that. I think the thing that upsets me about, I think a couple of things. I think that first of all, there are free alternatives to Facebook for some of its functionality. So there are things I can point to say, don't use this, use that. The other thing is that it's while people kind of get hooked on Facebook, Skype is something that people are just really unwilling to live without. And what drives me nuts about it is that I feel like you and I are the only two people in the world sometimes who refuse to use it, which I know isn't true. But it's like, it astounds me.
There's notably RMS, who actually has a .sig file for years, and he reinstituted a .sig file, like as long as I've known him, since 97, he didn't have a .sig file in his emails. And he recently, though not recently, but in the last 2 years for me, it's recently added a .sig file to raise the Skype issue. He added the .sig file that said, Skype, no way, I can't be reached by it.
But also Stallman can't readily be reached by phone anyway.
Well, I mean, if you just look at the trip file, you can call somebody who he's staying with. But the point is, he has a URL there that explains why Skype's bad. But it was important enough of an issue that he felt to add a .sig file, which he didn't have for years and years, to raise this issue about Skype. I think because he noticed people were putting their Skype ID in their .sig files and felt yep. that was something he needed to spread. So there's at least three of us, Karen.
Right. But that's exactly my point.
Well, yeah, it is the traditional proprietary software issue in the sense that it actually, you have to install a proprietary software client on your computer to be able to use it by design, yep. because it's doing all sorts of things that nobody knows what it's really doing.
Yep. I mean, the whole point of me bringing this up was to just agree with you, because I think that building these alternatives is probably the most important work that one can do for free software right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, but and then we're also, I mean, the thing is, it's a sad story right now because we're losing ground. You're still fighting the battle of the desktop, which I hope you won't be upset to me to say we're kind of losing mm-hmm. In various ways, and we've been fighting that for a decade and a quarter or so, and it's all still going on, and we're still losing ground, and this is why when I give my talk, we have a talk recording, maybe we'll use it at some point, for my talk I have on Scale on the same issue about the Affero GPL and so forth, which was actually before it turned out that FOSDEM happened. It was after this year because Scale was in February instead of January like it usually is. So my Scale talk, I talk about how we're going into the dark ages of software freedom. That's the next couple of decades, I think, are going to be really dark. I feel like we're back in the 80s where most of what people want to do is proprietary, because it's not proprietary in the same way it was in the 80s. It's not binary operating systems on your computer. Most of the operating systems are free software, but all the applications everyone wants to use are proprietary web services with JavaScript, proprietary JavaScript being shipped to your computer, or their Skype, right? So the most applications that people want to use every day, that the average person wants to use, are all proprietary.
That's funny, because I'm so full of optimism right now, having come to Tokyo from the GNOME Asia Summit, just because it was such an optimistic event, and really re-energizing. There's a lot of cool stuff going on.
Yeah, well, GNOME events are always that way. I've been to GWADEC a few times, and I do find GNOME events that kind of, they're some of the best conferences we have in free software for that reason. But you also have to consider that it's kind of a bubble. It's a group of people that are very enthusiastic, but it's such a small group compared to the onslaught of what's happening.
No, I don't disagree, but I'm not feeling it right now. The doom and gloom. I'm sure I will, and
I'm sorry. Sure I will. I didn't mean to bring it back to you, but
when I sit through the LinuxCon Japan tomorrow. No, I bet I'll stay optimistic through that, and then when I get home. But yeah.
It's funny because I've argued with Jim Zeman about this. He loves to talk about how open source is the default, and that's one you'll probably hear him say it in his keynote tomorrow. And the thing is that he's looking at a very, and I've told him this, so I don't mind saying it publicly, he's looking at a very narrow span, which is just the operating system. Because in the application space, open source is not the default. It's a proprietary software. It's not even an open source versus free software issue. It's proprietary is the default for applications. And that's been true for a very long time, and it's gotten worse, not better, in the last few years. And this is what I always used to complain about when people used to get excited when, say, Oracle ported to GNU Linux systems, that this was something good, this was a great outcome, it means we've made it as an operating system. That was my always worry, was that GNU Linux would become a platform for proprietary software, which it has. On the server side, on the whole DevOps world where people are deploying these proprietary applications using GNU Linux systems, it's become a platform for delivery of proprietary software.
It's very depressing.
Yeah, well, it just means we have work to do. I mean, this is what I've talked about. I talked about this.
Well, we always have work to do. I guess now I'm more doom and gloom and less optimism all of a sudden. But
I'm sorry. I really sort of beat you into it. I apologize.
Well, truth be told, I think part of it is that I'm coming down with a cold and it's getting very late at night in my hotel room. So, it's very easy to be brought down.
Well, Karen, tomorrow is another day.
I've always hated
that phrase.
Is it ridiculous? I don't know if I should admit this, but I'll admit it, that I actually was at a shrine today, and I wrote a little prayer down for free software.
Well, listeners already know I'm an atheist, so I don't think that's actually going to help. But I thought that where you're going when you mentioned a shrine was how being there in Tokyo and seeing if you saw some older structures, I haven't been to Asia before, but I think throughout Asia there's a sense of longevity. There's a respect for older things, and the time of the millennia going by is a more important issue than I think people in the U.S. And I think about free software as something that's a multi-generational task, and therefore the sense to which I'm optimistic is that I don't think that the free software movement's going to disappear. I just think that it has a lot more work to do, and it's going to take many generations to succeed.
Yeah, that's not, I mean, the longevity of it wasn't where I was going with it. It was the sort of like the seriousness and the somberness of really and earnestness, which I feel about free software. So, I agree with you that, it's going to take time, but I feel like we're in such a critical time right now.
I don't believe there are critical times. I don't really believe there are critical times.
I feel like the ground that we lose is just going to have so much greater, repercussions because of all the infrastructure that we're building.
Societally. I think I understand what you're saying, but this is why FairGPL is important. Because people writing new software under FairGPL, eventually somebody will write something that everybody wants to use. That's what happened with the GNU project and the Linux project. They both were key components that you needed to make an operating system work, and now we have it. And it beat BSD. I'm sorry, I guess I'll get angry emails from BSD people, but it succeeded and showed that software freedom is important, because the most popular installs of BSD are Apple systems that are proprietary. So it showed that making your software under the BSD license makes it popular, but it doesn't make it free. And doesn't give you the four freedoms, and so we won that battle. I think we showed that you need copyleft, that you need a focus on software freedom as part of your projects. I mean, even though Linux isn't a free software focused project, it's Linus has said the best decision he ever made was choosing the GPL. So he understands, even if he's not a free software person, that copyleft was important, and borrowed the license of the rest of the operating system to do that, and so. We'll just have to build the copyleft for the web, and we have to write all the software from scratch. It's the same job again.
Yeah, I mean, then there's the, you know, watching what's happening, you know, in the Android in the Android world as well. I don't know.
But on the operating system side, things are good in the Android space, more or less. I mean, there's the random GPL violator out there. As far as there's a few community GPL violations in the Android space that are annoying right now. But and they're perennially always GPL violators. But there is an operating system community that does modified versions of the operating systems for these devices. The applications are all proprietary.
This is what I'm saying, is the applications are all proprietary, but also the fracturing of the market means that it's difficult for any Android market to really approach the approach Apple because of the lack of standardization, which is in part because of the fractured proprietarization of it.
Yeah, I don't know if that. I don't know if I actually agree with that. It's pretty much the case because I've watched my wife do it. For example, install lots of proprietary apps on different Android devices, and they all basically work, even though they're very different Android devices. So I think that can be done.
Some apps do work on the different Android devices, but I do know of app developers that don't bother developing for Android because it's so much of a headache.
And they'd rather sell their soul to Apple to just have permission to put on their app store.
Oh, absolutely. That is exactly what they want.
It is true that certainly the boutique software development shop has been brought back by Apple iStore development, which is kind of disturbing, because I think people have a certain sense of liberation when they have their own small software company, and the small software company has kind of come back. But they're completely beholden to Apple, and I don't think they really understand that they could... that they live at the whim of Apple. It's like having a grant of land from the king or something like that, where you're like, oh, I'm a powerful lord. I have this grant of land from the king, but the king can just decide to give it to somebody else.
That's funny. I think that I think circling back on Apple is bad is probably a good place to end this, because we've been talking for a while and we've already the audio itself is quite long already.
Okay. All right. So we'll wrap it up, and we'll probably intersperse other content with the FOSDEM talk, since we're so far behind now. It's getting them slowly outly doesn't matter. And so folks will, as they heard in the last episode, or two episodes ago, wasn't a FOSDEM talk. The last one was, and the next one probably won't be. So hopefully folks will have some diversity there.
Hope you enjoy it. Reason Freedom is produced by Dan Lynch of Pod Factory and can be found at podfactory.org. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This episode of Reason Freedom is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. You can follow Reason Freedom, Bradley, and Karen on Identica, and also read Bradley's and Karen's blogs. Links can be found on the Reason Freedom website, faif.us. That's FAIF.us.
Bye.
scared.
Okay. But this is your slide.
Okay.
Yeah,
I
yes.
Okay. Which has all other notes. I thought it was going to be
the purpose of this is in case Bradley like forgets that there's actual text.
Wait a minute, are you saying there are these particular sections that might have proved troublesome in certain recounting of the chronologies? Or?
No, I don't know if we'll get into that, but you can talk about, often you can talk about a license without, you know, talking about its text, and the classic example is the LGPL, where some people take the text more seriously than others.
Are you starting now?
No, we're just starting like a minute.
This is our pre-talk
banter. This is for those of you that arrived early, you get to hear this wonderful, exciting banter about the LGPL. It's bonus content. Does the chair recognize the representative from the great state of New Media Goblin?